This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. International migration to North Carolina has increased dramatically in the last 25 years, and more than half of the state's foreign-born population is Latino. This influx of new immigrants has shaped the economy and culture of the state in profound ways, and today we're going to spend the hour talking about it. We're going to start with a recent report from UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School that examines the economic impacts of international migration to North Carolina. We're joined by one of the report's co-authors, Stephen Appold. Steve is a professor at Kenan Flagler. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us about the impetus behind this report. We're looking at a report that came out in 2014. That's actually a follow-up to a report that was done in the mid-2000s. Tell us about the impetus behind these reports.
Well, the migration to the state in general, and certainly immigration from abroad, has been one of the large demographic trends of the last quarter of the 20th century. And so we wanted to find out how that had been affecting the state. In addition, the North Carolina Bankers Association was interested in getting a grip on the potential market there. And so they commissioned the first report.
So it's interesting. I mean, everybody sees, or a lot of folks understand that there are great opportunities in this change in demographics. Bankers Association looking at potential customers. So who are they, and how do we market? Tell us. So who are they? Who makes up the immigrant population?
As of today, there's about 9.9 million residents in North Carolina. And close to 8% of that population, about 770,000, are immigrants. And by that, I mean those who were not born in this country or were born in another country to parents who were not U.S. citizens. Okay?
So it's about 750,000 total, somewhere around there.
Somewhere around there, but then an important point is there's another 450,000 or so native-born spouses and children that are part of what we count as immigrant households.
All right. And what part of that is the Hispanic population? Hispanics make up a large proportion of that immigrant population?
They make up somewhat more than half. There's about 830,000 Hispanics in the state, roughly half, over half of whom are immigrants.
And we should point out that this flow to when we talk about the immigration pattern over 25 years, we get a number, we see that it has increased by X amount. But the flow is dynamic. It changes. And certainly the crash of 2008 changed the flow of immigration now from Latin American countries to North Carolina, right?
At one point, that had basically reached zero, certainly from Mexico. Some of the Central American countries still sent a few. But the other point is not all the immigrants in the state came from overseas. Many of them had lived for quite some time in other states before coming to North Carolina. So they're fairly well acculturated.
So year over year, the number of people crossing into North Carolina might change, but we do know that there's a fair number of immigrants in the in North Carolina, and they've changed things. And there are a number of myths, and I think some of the questions that people ask are, you know, what are the economic effects? There's a sense that immigrants are taking a lot in terms of public service, not contributing much, and that they're a drain. And this is something that you looked at in particular.
That's right. Probably the focus of both the first report and the second one was trying to assess the overall economic impact. And as it turns out, that's something that's a little difficult to do, mainly because there's very little consensus on how to measure it. So what we've done is look in several directions. And on balance, that seems to be positive. That is, the labor market impact appears to be positive. Immigrant labor resulted in about $1.7 billion in wage savings, about less than 1% of the total wage bill. And we keep looking for, but keep not finding, evidence of substantial labor market competition. In other words, immigrants especially Hispanic immigrants, have by and large gone into industries and occupations that the native-born were already leaving.
Okay. So explain that. Talk about those professions or those occupations and why the native population, native-born population, was leaving and how you know that.
Well, all migration and especially immigration tends to follow what's sometimes called an hourglass form, where lots of people come in at the bottom for the jobs that natives don't want, and they also come in towards the top for the jobs the natives are not prepared to handle. And that's certainly true in North Carolina, where, let me see if I can find some notes here, we need to import about half those who work on our farms, about a third of the construction workers, a third of the professionals, and about 30% of the state's managers.
In other words, those vacancies were present. It was that signal to, let's call this a market, a labor market, that goes into, in many cases, Mexico. There's a signal. We need work here. It's not people coming here pushing people out of work. They're, in effect, in this kind of invisible hand sort of way, reading a signal.
That's correct. And in fact, as the recession began to hit the U.S., you could trace where the recession was pinching by where immigrants left, all right? And for most of the last decade, previous decade, North Carolina was a very attractive place for immigrants, but also migrants from the rest of the country. Immigrants were only about a third of the people who came to the state during the first decade of this century.
Right. So embedded in what you're saying, first of all, before we lose the point, they're coming here to work.
That's
so when
right.
you get here,
that's
you
right.
work.
Immigrants
and you earn
work
money.
At a higher rate than native-born
but
people.
But they're not paying taxes.
Well, in fact, they are. Even if somebody is a day laborer and does not report their income, they pay taxes every time they make a purchase in the store, every time they pay rent. And so given their incomes, they probably pay about as much taxes as anybody else doing the same sort of work.
We're talking about immigration in North Carolina, the economic impact. It turns out to be positive, according to a report by Keenan Flagler, a business school at UNC Chapel Hill. Talking about that today on The State of Things. My guest is Stephen Appold, who is a professor at UNC's Keenan Flagler Business School. So, immigrants do pay taxes. Some of them are actually on the books with a worker identification number, have taxes taken out. Many are off the books, but they're paying sales tax. They're paying property tax in the form of rent, unless they own, and then they're paying their mortgage. And, of course, they're spending money into the economy. You took that into account and weighed that against those costs that we can measure, education, for instance, and some of the other costs. Of course, there are very few actual transfer benefits. There are no things of food stamps or any of the kind of care that we think of as welfare. It doesn't go to people who are not documented.
That's right. Less than 1% of the immigrant households receive means-tested income. Slightly more receive the equivalent of food stamps, and those are mostly native-born children.
Under
10%. But still, that's a small percentage of the immigrant households.
So then but education is something that is available to everybody. The state spends money on that. So what's the comparison there in terms of the amount of money spent into the economy, taxes paid, versus the benefit of education?
It still comes out positive most of the time. But education is the large cost post, not only for immigrants, but for all of us. And so that's the major source of cost so far, partly because of health cultures, partly because of age. Healthcare costs have been lower than we'd expect. Law enforcement, public safety costs, and we included a broad range of factors in there. Those are fairly low also. But because the immigrants tend to be relatively young, and young people who are doing well tend to have children, immigrants are child rich. And that's what drives most of the public costs of immigration.
And again, the net, if we're just doing just pure dollars and cents, state, that is government programs, government spending versus money that comes back to us in the in terms of taxes and spending, the net is what?
I did not bring that number with me, unfortunately.
But there is a number, and it's a net positive.
It's a net positive. It's about positive. That's a number that varies from state to state and over time. What we're thinking is when you combine the labor market impacts, the spending impacts, the tax impacts, the cost impacts, that's a net positive to the state.
That's the economic outlook, and I want to thank you, Steve Appold, for guiding us along the research. Thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Stephen Appold is a professor at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School. We're going to continue the conversation now to look at some of the cultural issues and benefits of our migrant population here in North Carolina and what it is like to come here from another place and work. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about immigration in North Carolina. We just heard about the impact it's making on the state's economy. But of course, at the core of any economy are people, workers, and we turn now to hear some of their stories. According to the Migration Policy Institute, as of 2013, North Carolina was home to some 750,000 foreign-born residents, and more than half are Latino. In the Triangle, hundreds of Latina women earn their living as house cleaners. Many of them are undocumented, and they've been in the country for more than a decade. A new photography exhibit at Duke documents the life histories of some of these women in Durham, and I'm joined by three of them today. Marilu was born in a small town in the state of Puebla, Mexico. She now lives in Durham and runs her own cleaning service, Marilu's Cleaning Service. Welcome, Marilu. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Araceli was born and raised in Guanajuato, Mexico. She came to the U.S. when she was 15 years old. Araceli, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Gracias.
And Elizabeth is from Mexico City. She served as a research coordinator for this project. Elizabeth, welcome. Good to have you here.
Muchas gracias.
We are joined today by two interpreters who will translate for us, Jackie Mativier and Grisel Diaz. Welcome to both of you as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
Elizabeth, you were the research coordinator for this project. Tell us a bit about the project itself and what the focus of the project is.
Well, we're focusing on the people to value all the job and work that we do that is hard work. And a lot of people, like, it doesn't take it into consideration. They just look at us like they're mates. Not everybody, but people do see us like that. I like people to be thankful. We help them, and they also help us, giving us a job, and we appreciate it.
Se los agradecemos mucho.
Tell us some of the aspects of being of your work, cleaning houses, that we may overlook, ways in which you are in some ways invisible.
Invisible, I think, because people don't even thank us. There are people that we get there and they don't even say hello. They leave and they don't say goodbye. It's like we don't exist for them. Like we're just, you know, like the girl that cleans the house and that's it.
La muchacha que limpia la casa y ya.
Marilu, you own your own company. Can you tell us about it and a little bit about a day in the life, an average day for you?
I clean houses on my own, and I pressure the people who I'm working with them. They are very nice people. I met them just in the restaurant when I had been working, others in the streets, others just for recommendations. And I feel grateful. I feel happy with my job because I have the ability to spend time with my girls.
You talked about working in restaurants, and originally that's the work you were doing here when you first got here. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. My first job was in UCLA in California.
Why did you switch to house cleaning?
Because I have been working in restaurant for maybe 13 years, and I spent all my time in the restaurant. So I was tired, and I didn't watch my kids, and I felt like I'm not a good mother. And I start thinking about the school, and I have to take care more to my daughter, Amy, in that time. So I start thinking to do something by my own, but I don't have money to do something else. I don't have the education to get a better job. So that one thing I think I know how to do is clean houses.
So Marilu, it would seem to me that restaurant work might be more interesting just because you're coming in contact with more people. I mean, is that true? And was it a difficult decision for you? I understand you did it for your children, but how about the work?
Yeah, it was a difficult decision because in that time I was manager in the restaurant. I had been working so hard to get in that position. I did a cashier, waitress, bartender, supervisor, and then a manager. But I spent more hours in the restaurant, and I was thinking I can make the same money and spend more time with my girls. So I made some cards, and then I started. And I feel so grateful because the woman who I cleaned her house the first time, I'm still working with her.
Araceli, one aspect of this project is documenting your stories of migration to North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about your story. How did you get here?
Yo estaba muy chica cuando... I was very young when I decided to come to the United States. The reason was because my parents did not have the money so that I could continue studying at school. And when I came, I found a person that would cross people across the border illegally, and I paid him money. And that is how I came to this country.
Yeah, I know you've had worked for a variety of families in the area. You've had both positive and negative experiences. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of experiences you've had?
My first experience that I had working as a housekeeper was when I had my first job. The lady told me that I would work at her home from Monday through Sunday, and she was only going to pay me from $80 to $100 a week, because she was going to save the money for me to get an attorney so the attorney could find the permit for me to stay in the U.S. A year and a half went by, and she never said anything about it, so I asked. And she said, oh, there's a problem. The attorney said there's nothing we can do for you. So I lost all that money. It was money that I was really investing for an attorney. So I decided to leave that job and find something else. But it was difficult because it's like starting from scratch.
Pero fue difícil porque es como empezar sin nada otra vez.
And you really couldn't do anything about that. If you felt you'd been cheated, could you go to anybody, to the authorities, and try to get your money back?
No, porque en ese tiempo...
No, because at the time I didn't speak English very well, and I didn't know who to go to. I was very young. I didn't know anything.
No sabía nada.
Elizabeth, you've been in the country for 19 years. What are some of the challenges in working, the work that you do, and raising a family?
Well, my challenge is to be a single mom. 2 years ago, my oldest is married. He lives on his own. He has a son. And I live with my son, Jonathan, and my baby, Giselle. Now, they are the ones that push me to go forward.
Araceli, your husband works in construction. What are some of the differences in the types of work that men can do and women can do?
Well, the only difference is their strength, because they're stronger than a woman is. But the intelligence is the same. and they can do a better work in construction. But as women, we are intelligent too. We can have better jobs and improve ourselves all the time, as long as we think positively.
Marilu, you've started your own business. What are some of the challenges that you faced in starting your own business?
Nobody knows what are you doing, and if the people trust of you entering their houses and clean the house. And then how I will charge to the people, because I don't know how to charge for my job.
Also, you have to drive for your work, don't you?
Yeah, that's right.
So what are the challenges there?
For me, it's not a challenge. It will be a challenge for many people.
Could you get a driver's license?
I can't, and I don't have it, one. But I had been living in this country for many years. So I don't feel different. I don't feel insecure. So I manage my own in everywhere, and God bless me, because I don't have any problems with a policeman.
Elizabeth, let me ask you, have you ever been in a situation where you felt perhaps you were being treated unfairly, but you didn't really feel like you could talk to anybody about it, that you could go to anyone and get justice for the situation that happened to you in the home?
Not too long ago, we left the house because of that, because the women wanted to treat us like slaves. She told us, she pulled the things and she said, "You clean there already. Something has been missing. Don't take that liquid." A lady really problemly, so we stopped going there. And it was just been only 3 times that we have been cleaning with her, but no. So we decided to just leave that house.
Araceli, you talked about the fact that there's no difference, you know, in terms of the intelligence of men and women. But do you find that when you go to work, that some people are treating you because you're maybe not speaking the same language, as though, you know, you're not bright enough, you know, you're just not getting it?
What
happens is there are people that don't even give you the opportunity if you can speak English well or not. They simply answer, I can't talk to you because you're not going to understand me. They don't even take the time to find out if you really can understand or not. And that is very sad, because they don't even give you a chance. And although this has happened to me, they don't know that I know how to speak English. I just don't say anything.
Simplemente no digo nada.
When you're there and you're just not saying anything, what's going through your mind? What would you like to say?
I would like to tell them I'm a human too. We can all have an opportunity in life, and they should ask if we speak the language. That is more than anything. And I think they would understand that.
Pienso que ellos lo entenderían.
People hearing this story might think to themselves, both what you and Elizabeth have just said about the kind of treatment you get from time to time, well, why do you stay here? Why wouldn't you go back to Mexico?
Yo estoy aquí principalmente porque
I am here basically because I believe that all of the Hispanic, Latino people, we're here for one reason, to make a better life and improve ourselves. If I had enough money to continue studying or the support in my country, I would not have made the trek. Unfortunately, that was the reason why I had to leave and why I'm here. To me, this has been quite a challenge. First, I was by myself. I now have a family. I have 3 children. One of them is already in college and another about to graduate. And the other one is in high school. And I'm very happy with myself, because I have been able to guide them and give them a better future. Just because I didn't have the opportunity doesn't mean that they can have a better one. And I state that because if I can do it, anyone else can do it as well.
Y yo lo digo porque si yo he podido salir adelante, todos pueden.
Marilu, let me ask you about President Obama's executive order, relaxing enforcement for those who have been here. Does that have any impact on you?
Yes, this executive action helped me a lot,
because I want to go back to college. It's something I was dreaming. And I definitely, when I got my permission, I'm going to go back to the community college. I already choose the classes I will take, and I'm planning to do a company to help others. Not a company as just to have a benefit on me. It's to help a woman build a better life, like I want it for me.
Araceli, when you talk about helping others, you heard Marilu talk about creating a business that would help others. How well connected do you feel with other Latina women? Do you have time to talk, and do you feel supported in the Latina community?
Sí, y más que sentir el apoyo,
yes.
Yo también se los doy.
And more than the support, I also provide support, because one of the ways that I can get closer to my children is by being a volunteer at my children's school, by helping other Latino families that don't speak English as well. That helps me, because if I help them, I'm helping myself by being closer to my children.
Y me ayudo yo misma a estar cerca de mis hijos.
Marilu, what about participation sort of in the greater community? On the one hand, there might be plenty of activities within the Latino community, and you could feel very well connected. Is there a sense, any sense of isolation in not being connected with the greater community?
No, I don't feel like that. I feel very, very self-confident about that. I don't feel isolation, and I do a lot of work of community. And I try to bring my community to the English speakers, and they can feel like it's fine if you can speak, but try to do it, and you will do it.
Araceli, I'll put the same question to you. Do you feel connected to the larger community outside the Latino community?
Sí, porque creo que como Latina...
Yes, because as a Latina, if you get closer to other people, there's no difference. We need each other, especially if you're helping them out. I live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of older people, 80 and older, and I feel very thankful to be living around them. I'm the youngest one in the neighborhood, and all the time I stop by and I ask them, do you need something? They're older people, they can fall down, they might need my help, so they're very happy that I'm around, because they might not need my help, but they might need my husband. It could be fixing a door, or maybe help them pick something up that's heavy or come down the stairs. That makes me feel better every time.
Y eso me hace sentir mejor cada vez.
Elizabeth, what advice would you give women coming to this country to help them make the adjustment?
Pues el consejo que yo le daría,
my advice is to keep forward, behave, because there are some people that they come over here to do bad things. For example, there are a lot of people, many women, that are here. They do have documents. They were born here, but they don't work. They don't do anything. They just in their homes watching TV. This country is to work. Everyone that comes over here, we have to work. So if we want to get involved with the other community, we have to work so they can see that we're good people.
How would you survive here if you weren't working, though?
Ay, la verdad no sé.
I really tell you the truth, I don't know. Perhaps with my family's help in Mexico, my mother, I have a lot of friends here also. But if I don't work, I think I would have died.
Yo creo que ya me hubiera muerto.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions that Americans have about you and your work in this country? Marilu, I'll start with you.
I think the misconception is because I work as a maid, that means I can pay taxes and not pay bills, and I can sustain my house or my family. I feel sometimes they don't understand we are person, we are humans. We are in here because we want a better life, and we want the opportunity that United States does for everyone.
Araceli?
Uno de los principales malos entendidos es que...
One of the biggest misconceptions is that people in the U.S. think that we're here to take away their jobs and that we are a burden to them. One more thing, they need to help us and we don't provide help for them. I think that is the biggest error. We come here to work very hard. Many times we do the hardest work that they are not willing to do and they pay the least. And we still pay taxes in helping our children and helping the community. And there's very few people, Americans, that understand that.
Y es muy poca gente que reconoce eso.
Thank you. My guests are Araceli, Barilu, and Elizabeth. Three of them work as house cleaners in Durham. They all participated in a photography project about house cleaners, now on view at Duke University's Perkins Library. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were joined by interpreters Jackie Mativier and Grizel Diaz. Thank you both for being on the program as well.
Thank you.
We continue our conversation about immigration in North Carolina in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. As the national conversation about immigration continues, we're looking at immigration in our own state, focusing on the lives of more than 390,000 Latino immigrants in North Carolina. We just heard the stories of three women who earn their livings as house cleaners, and we turn now to examine some of the underlying elements of migration. We're going to join now by three people who work closely on these issues. Liliana Paredes is a linguist and a professor of Spanish at Duke who assisted with the House Cleaner Project. Liliana, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is Yuri Ramirez. She is a doctoral student at Duke University in the History Department, and she specializes in Mexican migration to the United States. Welcome back, Yuri.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Luke Smith, a psychiatrist and executive director of El Futuro, an organization that provides behavioral health treatment for underserved Spanish-speaking individuals. Luke Smith, good to have you here as well.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Liliana, let me start with you. Tell us a little bit about this, because I know you're involved both with the project at Duke and also this question of language and linguistics and how important that is to people who are coming to this country and trying to make the adjustment.
It is very important, and, well, for many reasons. One of the reasons why being able to use your language, it's because it's so connected to your identity. Yeah. And the fact that people are put into a different context where they need to also understand and perform in another language gives them a different challenge. It's the negotiation of their own identity. How am I going to present myself to the others when I know that because I have an accent or because I have a I don't speak English at all, I will be considered with certain characteristics, like one of the ladies said before, I think it was Araceli, you know, people think we're dumb because we don't speak the language, and that's not at all. So they are forced to negotiate not only with themselves, but also with the community, with the people they have to work with, the people they have to engage on everyday activities. So language is a big issue in this process of immigration when you are talking about individuals who speak another language. In many cases also, some of these individuals don't speak Spanish as a first language. I don't think it's the case of any of the women that you talked to about, but sometimes they speak indigenous languages from the countries they come from.
So that's another barrier in some ways. And so interesting, the light that you shined on this question of identity. We sort of think we are who we are, but we are who we say we are.
Exactly.
And we say we are who we are in our language. And
exactly.
So if you come to a place and have to express not just the simple day-to-day things, which can be hard enough, but if you have a question about your human rights, civil rights, all of those, whether or not you're being cheated, the idea that you can't express yourself in your native language to try to express these ideas, to bring yourself across, must be a terribly a lonely feeling. It must have psychological impact.
Yes, definitely. It is hard for a woman, just being a woman, even if you speak English, you know, to articulate your voice and express your and happiness when things are going on around you. And imagine when you're a woman who speaks another language and not being able to articulate their thinking or their complaints or what they feel as infractions of their human rights, you know. That puts you in a level of I don't know, I don't want to say sadness, but even beyond sadness, you know, it's unfair.
Yuri, take us back a little bit to give us a brief history of the history of Latino migration to North Carolina.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, Latinos have been migrating to the United States since before the Mexican Revolution in 1910. Women particularly started migrating in bigger numbers after the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, which provided sort of for family unity, family reunification, right? And so that's when scholars articulate the feminization of migration occurred in the 1980s. And particularly women started coming in that time, often with their families, their children, and sometimes even single women, which is a lot of the case of what we see of women here in North Carolina, first-generation migrants, right? Women, single women who come and move here. And North Carolina really experienced a boom of sort of permanent migration, particularly Mexican migration, in that period in the 1980s, but really solidified in the 1990s, which is when we see a real significant percentage increase, right? North Carolina experienced the largest percentage increase of a Latino population between 1990 and 2000 of any of the states in the United States, almost 400% increase.
What was drawing people to North Carolina then?
There are a lot of reasons that were occurring on both sides of the border, which is what I think we have to keep in mind. Oftentimes, we forget, right? So certainly, North Carolina was experiencing its own sort of industrial and agricultural boom in places like Charlotte and in Raleigh, right? But certainly the poultry processing plants and everything. And so they were really looking for low-wage labor, unskilled labor. At that same time, right, if you look across the border in Mexico, 1994, the North American Free Trade Agreement really disenfranchised a lot of people in the states where people are coming from, like in Guanajuato and in Michoacán, Puebla, people that were farmers become disenfranchised through NAFTA because the U.S. is able to sell corn at lower rates than Mexican local farmers are able to. And so these people are left selling all of their land and selling everything they have to come to the United States. And so people are starting to come in the 1990s because of that, certainly.
And interestingly enough and paradoxically, that migration had been pretty fluid back and forth. Most people for a long time had been coming, working, earning some money and going back. It was paradoxically the tightening of immigration laws that really forced people or allowed people to make the decision to stay.
Certainly. I mean, Operation Gatekeeper, too, right, in the 1990s was the sort of the project that militarized the border. And it certainly led, like, places of frequent crossing, right, El Paso, Laredo, Tijuana, like, these places were closed off, essentially, which really drew people into those deserted areas of the border that are desert. That's where all of the people are dying. Hundreds of bodies are found. And so certainly these immigration controls have, I think, done the opposite because also, like you said, a flowing sort of migration of people back and forth of like seasonal work has turned into people staying in the United States, permanent residents.
Right. And of course, the reason for that is you say, well, wait a minute, I might not make it. Was easy
exactly.
to go back and forth. I might not make it. Mm-hmm. I better stay where I am. And
right.
so it had the effect of keeping people here
exactly.
instead of keeping that flow going. So and it's changed, I think, the impact. North Carolina used to be a little bit easier on immigration as a state because states also have their own control.
Yeah.
That has changed as well. What kind of impact has the changing nature of law in North Carolina had on the lives of immigrants?
Yeah, well, I think North Carolina, people started moving here also. Like in the 1990s, states of California were passing these anti-immigrant laws, right? And so people started moving to the southeast because there weren't a lot of Latinos or Mexicans here, right? So sort of the visibility was sort of cast aside. Certainly that started to change, and particularly through like driver's licenses and 287G secure communities, right? So in particularly in the 2000s and especially after 9/11, North Carolina sort of started. Policymakers were articulating this discourse of terrorism and that these migrants were bringing all these things to North Carolina. So by 2006, the assembly had successfully, you know, won sort of the stopping of allowing undocumented migrants to have licenses, right? And then by 2009, we have secure communities, which essentially allows local law enforcement to hold sort of the power that federal immigration agencies have. And this certainly has changed, I think, the whole environment of migrants here. It certainly made them much more vulnerable, much more scared. It's like this fear that controls your life. Like these women were talking about having to drive without licenses, right? And these are the risks they take, the challenges that they face just to work and provide for their children.
So, Luke Smith, what are some of the psychological challenges then that you see that may or may not be generated by those factors?
Well, it stems from the fear that she's talking about. And I'm impressed with the previous guests who talk about their own experiences coming into the United States. And perhaps they were looking for something so much more, to see the American dream, to help their family in so many different ways. And then to come against some barriers and some realities here that engenders such fear really does impact the psyche. And as we see people come into our interactions in the healthcare system and in those environments, we start to see people who articulate what we've heard, which is they feel very invisible. They feel replaceable. They feel nameless and voiceless. And they oftentimes only come in when things have gotten worse, because they are afraid to come in when things are not that bad. But that's when we would prefer they come in.
How does it manifest? What do we see then in terms of behavior and how that affects their lives?
So it's a lot of healthy people who come into stressful environments, and they then become affected by these stressful environments with depression, with anxiety. Maybe it's a previous trauma in a home country of war or violence there. Maybe it's the violence of or victimization that happens at the border, or maybe it's once they get to our communities. Or maybe it's just the stress of poverty. But those things can start to provoke the same types of reactions we see in our soldiers who've experienced violence, PTSD, for instance.
It was interesting. I asked Ariseli in the previous segment about her coming to the U.S., and we knew her backstory. And she said, well, we didn't have a lot of money. I wanted an education. I hired a man who helped me across the border, and then I got to North Carolina. Now, I know the rest of that story. It is not that simple. There are some horrors along the way that she chose not to tell, and I chose not to press because that wasn't relevant to our conversation. There are deep backstories, and yet that's how, if I were to ask her as a kind of a stranger, the story I'd get. I was poor, got a coyote, and here I am. Mm-hmm. So, Liliana, we were talking about linguistics and sort of the challenge of, because Luke is going to need somebody to tell them the story before he can do any good, right?
Right.
Again, we're coming back to the challenges, not only language, but all of the experiences that men and women bring with them to this country.
Yeah, and it will take some time to gain the trust of the people who, if they want to tell us the stories, and how they want to frame it as well, because when Luke was talking about the American dream that they come to fulfill, and honestly, my question is, where did they hear about this American dream? And from my interactions with people in the community, you know, I understand that somehow they embrace this discourse of the American dream, and in contrast to what they're living, the American dream seems so unreachable. And I said, well, where did you hear about this American dream? But they have these stories of challenges and struggles that they want to fulfill, and they are very strong women, very strong people. And we tend to see only that part when we work with them, and we forget the other part, you know, the stories that they don't tell us. So we need to hear behind those words, behind that, the language they use to talk about their situations. And I'm always wondering when I hear, the first thing I hear is I'm very grateful because I have a job here. I can do it. I have some money. But there is more beyond that act of thinking, you know. Mm-hmm. There is something else. And I think in order to become a healthier community that embrace these other communities, you know, we need to be open to listen beyond the words, you know. And also, as I heard sometimes ago, listen with an accent, you know, just forget about the accents that you hear and embrace the differences, the linguistic differences, because if we don't embrace them, people will not talk.
Luke, can you tell us about some of the legal and funding challenges that you face in trying to do your job?
So sometimes I feel like the struggle that they feel is then put up on us as healthcare providers, because we interact with people. We find that there are policies and there are some things that are above us that we can't control that really do impact our work. And so we start to feel in a similar way unable to really affect change. And this American dream of not only making it rich, but also having democracy, having a voice, we feel like we can't really make any difference. And so we see policies that come down that start to really emphasize crisis care and not prevention. And early intervention is not prioritized. And so we see these issues grow and fester. And only when it's so late and so disastrous on that family do people come in for help. And they're still scared to come in.
Is there a difference between the, because you see documented and undocumented immigrants, I'm sure. That may be a way to sort of shine a light on the impact of fear, people who can't come out. Is there a difference in the way they approach you and you approach them? Not so much your approach, but the way they come to you if they're documented or not.
So the way our organization postures, we don't do any check on the front end. But we have chosen places where people feel naturally more comfortable, maybe not a place right next to a police station, though we work with police. And even still, we see people not wanting to talk to school officials about their problems. So it'll be a really impassioned school social worker or teacher who calls us up and says, hey, can you see this little boy and his family? They know it's a family issue. And so that's how people come in, is through more indirect routes, or talking to a primary care provider, a doctor at their clinic. They say something, and then the doctor calls us up.
I want to thank all of you. Wish we had more time, but thank you for being on the program. Luke Smith is a psychiatrist and executive director of El Futuro. Yuri Ramirez is a doctor student at Duke in the history department. And Liliana Paredes is a linguist and a professor of Spanish at Duke University. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. We have more information at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director, Jess Clark, the intern, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.